There's a sign and sheet going around, if you would just put down your name and position, you know, keeping track of my data, and name and email address, that would be good. You'll also get a survey, post-survey from Melissa. Melissa is the GA for the Center for Faculty Development. So you'll get a survey asking about this event and asking for your feedback. So we'll probably want to start, but I just want to remind you, so there are a few more events coming up before the semester ends. There's one next week on sabbatical, and so how to have a successful sabbatical, planning for it, re-entry, all the things that, making sure you actually accomplish things while you're on your sabbatical. That's always a challenge, Exactly, yes, besides on the speech. After that is teaching beyond the classroom using the archives and the Walsh Library. We have Alan Dorr and Jean Brazilli presenting on that. What has become our traditional end of semester meditation workshop. So as you head into finals and your final batch of grading, that's May 1st, Peter Sabastano is leading that. And then a project syllabus workshop. We had one before, but we're reprising it because a lot of people asked about it. But also keep in mind the summer writing retreat, which has also become very popular. There are only so many seats, but it is by application. So that will be the 3 days after commencement. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, the 21st, 22nd, 23rd. It's proved to be very helpful for people starting summer writing. So that you don't turn around and realize it's suddenly June 15th and you haven't done another one. Right? For July 15th. Okay, so in the meantime, I know we're expecting a few more people, but we will start without them. I'd like to introduce Nick Snow, who is currently Director of the Office of Grants and Research Services.
Not for long.
Okay. I just want to make sure I got the OGRS part right. Okay. But and is with the chemistry department and is also what's the position you hold?
I'm founding endowed professor.
There you go. Okay. So there you go. Yeah. Sorry. That's okay.
Oh, look at that. Here's the team. All right.
Are you co-presenting with us?
No, I'm just here.
It's kind of creepy. You want to sit here?
I think you should start.
I'm good. One of the things I have learned in my various stints of administration is not to spend too much time sitting down.
Are we ready down here? All right. We're going to ask Nick to take it away.
Thank you. Thanks, Mary. And again, I think we will go once around in the room, and I guess I probably will offer a disclaimer that I had to sign one of those releases that the thing is being audio recorded. However, when you speak, you do not have to identify yourself, so please don't, because one thing I also want to do, of course, especially from our more junior colleagues or from anybody, is to encourage. Let's have discussion, let's have fun. Notice that unlike my two dean colleagues here in the room, I am not a tie-wearing administrator. If it were me, I would ask them to remove their ties in this room so they can step out of those roles a little bit. Before we go once around the room, I'll also introduce my bit of a wingman here, Peter Shoemaker of the Union College of Arts and Sciences. Mary Ann Lloyd, unfortunately, called out sick today. So she will not be joining us, but I think hopefully we'll be able to manage. I'm Nick Snow from chemistry. I was actually received a very nice letter from then Provost Rocha almost 20 years ago to this day, awarding me tenure, or telling me that he was recommending me, one or the other of those things, but it worked out that way. So let's go once around the room and everybody, quick introduce yourself, and then we'll get into the stuff. John, please.
John Fishman, Dean of the University Libraries.
Peter Shoemaker, Dean of Arts and Sciences.
Pablo Gadens from Biblical Studies, School of the Arts.
Joe Bonillo, Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry.
Tony Lovisa, Chair of Finance.
I'm Mark Hedera from the Library.
I'm Mary Balkin, Finance Department.
I'm Andy Simon, Department of Technology.
You're the only person here from education, which annoys me. Yeah. Anyway,
get after your colleagues.
No, it's not my colleagues. My colleagues are wonderful. Yeah.
I'm from the library. Caitlin Camieri from the library.
Dawn Adler, sociology and pathology position.
Greg Weaven, also from the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry.
Melissa Martini, graduate assistant for the CFD.
Thank you all. So I guess I commented about Greg and Joe here, also for our colleagues in the library. At least you all know where your bread is buttered. Your dean showed up. You were here. We'll have some fun with that. So let's start off with a question for everybody. And I know I've got a couple of university teaching fellows in here. And I know I talked about this. We talked about this together with you guys. Why do we make such a big deal about tenure in higher education? I'm not intending to answer that question just yet. I'm hoping that some of you might have some ideas.
Job security.
John?
Protects
academic freedom.
To be quite blunt about it, depends on whether or not you have a union, I guess.
That has something to do with it as well. Let's not go. Thank God we do not. Mary?
There's actually a recent article in, I think it was the Chronicle, I'm in higher ed, which talked about the fact that tenure, in fact, guarantees service to the university. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we provide is faculty is service, and tenure enables that to happen. Otherwise, faculty would simply not, in many cases, not do it.
Faculty position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it has a role in governance as well. I mean, it may be implicit in what you said about academic freedom, but we can talk about academic freedom in the classroom, we can talk about academic freedom in research, and we can also talk about the ability in a university where you're supposed to be pursuing knowledge for people to disagree with the administration.
Or each other
in an honest way where people don't feel that their jobs are at risk, but rather we're all pursuing the common good by confronting ideas against one another.
Yeah. Sure. So can you think of any other industry where tenure exists besides education?
Federal judgeships.
And that was actually, John, that's a great comment. One of the first tenured professors that was a mentor to me when I was in graduate school made that exact comment, that a tenured professor is a lot like a federal judge. I mean, it is both, and of course those have their blessings and their curses, which we'll get into a little bit.
Partnerships are not in some ways unlike tenure, where the conditions of your entrance into a partnership and departure from that partnership are regulated by a set of contractual agreements that assume that unless something is breached or unless someone gives you some kind of compensation, you cannot be pulled out of the partnership without your own permission.
So it's a pretty, I think we had some great ideas here. It's a pretty broad idea. It's also, I think Peter will probably touch on this a little bit more from his perspective as a dean. It provides broad freedom, but also very broad responsibility. And I think that's one of the things I'm very glad we've got some of our senior colleagues here, because some of these folks, they're demonstrating a little bit of that responsibility by being here only at the request of a presenter, and the presenter's charm and good looks or something to get them here. And that's, I think, one of the, to me also one of the blessings of having tenure is also having some of the judgment to choose some of these things that, that we do. So in this session, I started doing this, I came to my first one of these probably almost 25 years ago when I was maybe a first or second year assistant professor. I made the mistake of continuing to show up to them. And back then they were presented by Al Hakem, for whom the Faculty Service Medal is named, and Professor Phil Kahl, who is still one of our well-known and well-loved on this campus emeritus faculty. So I kept showing up to it. And then what happened was that when Phil and Al got to the point of retiring and not wanting to do it anymore, they said, Nick, you have to keep doing this. And it sort of became one of those things that I kept doing. And then the Center for Faculty Development got started, and we brought it under that aegis. So again, this is very informal. Let's have some fun with it and hopefully learn a little bit about tenure. A few things we'll talk about. Let's talk a little bit about the faculty guide. It's kind of interesting. We spend three articles of the whole faculty guide on things related to appointments, promotion, and tenure. Three out of what, 15 articles. So it's probably, if you think about that in a way, it's the biggest article, the biggest piece of our faculty guide. some things that will go along with that, and we'll talk about sort of the, you know, kind of go through the process. Actually, just a quick survey. I know Greg's in his first year, Joe's in his second. Some of the junior folks, what year are you all in so far?
They're both first.
First year, Dawn?
I'm finishing
your second year. So you're about to have
third.
So you're going on your third year, and Joe also. So next year, you and Joe are going to have your third year reviews in your department, which
I
is a, you're having it now. So that's which is an important step along the way. As was relatively recently instituted. One thing you'll also find, again, probably if you look back to, let's say the day when, you know, when Tony and Mary and I came up, and perhaps when Mary Ezekiel came up as well, senior faculty, how much formal guidance did you all get?
Zero.
I got a lot.
I got zero.
Formal.
I got a lot.
Formal.
I got a lot.
Okay. Yeah. We got zero.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'm going to say zero. A ton of informal guidance, but pretty much zero. There, you know, the idea of in your department, were you ever handed a document that said something like promotion and tenure standards,
yeah,
like when you applied for the job or when you got the job?
Yes.
Did you get that, junior folks? Did you get that?
We
call it expectations of faculty.
We did.
We did
not at the time. At least I didn't.
There's no clear, like, this is what you need to do.
Yeah.
No, they're not clear, but they are printed and not available on the internet.
We do it now.
Yes. Preconceived notions of what was.
Yes, we didn't. Well, that's the thing. We do those things now. We didn't do them years ago, and so the level of that we didn't do it university wide. They may have done it in your department, but not ours. Certainly not in the College of Arts and Sciences. And there are still a number of departments in your college that don't do it.
Yes, there are.
So,
no, that's not true.
That's it. Or that had not done it until very recently. But that's, you know, one thing. So we get a bit more guidance today, which can also be good. Now, so for instance, one of the things that hadn't been enforced hardly at all, again, when I came up, I think I had 2 out of 5 annual evaluations that were actually done. Things like that. So we'll talk about some of the things that you want to make sure get done. We'll talk about a few other things that are sort of in the process, like external reviews. When we get ready for the process, and we'll talk a little bit about these departmental standards documents. I think we've already talked a little bit about being on tenure, and that there is some responsibility there, and I'm hoping some of our senior colleagues will also share a little bit of the experience that, okay, I've got tenure, what next, and share a little bit about that. And of course, let's discuss. So the faculty guide, Yeah, so and actually I forgot they renumbered articles in the faculty guide, so there may be a few typos in the slide. But it's kind of interesting about probationary appointments, and that's still, I guess, what we're still calling them, if that's correct.
Yes.
We're still calling them probationary appointments. Okay, come on, come back here. I was going to flip out of there. But there are a few things. First of all, okay, come back. There we go. One of the things to keep an eye on, and again, go back, if you don't have it, make sure you actually have a copy of your appointment letter that you got when you were hired. Make sure that you look at that appointment letter, make sure you check the dates in it for when your mandatory tenure review is. That's probably one of the number one things to do, is make sure you know when that is, and make sure that that we're working toward it. Again, if you have one of those things, be sure that things have that they lined up things correctly in it. Like if they did give you years or semesters of credit from a previous place, do the dates all line up? So you might, again, this is especially first year folks, it's a good time to go back and double check to be sure that they actually did all of that stuff correctly. Mistakes have happened, and it can be really, it gets difficult in the committees and with the deans when you come up and you put the documentation together in your tenure package and the appointment letter says one thing and what you have done is another, or what has been done is another, and that has happened a number of times when I've been on the committees. So just double check on, you know, early on is a good time to double check on those things. A couple things that might happen. It's kind of an interesting thing also. Did any of you all actually negotiate any, you know, extra years toward tenure from previous?
Years toward tenure.
Toward your tenure review. So you get a couple of years off because you did a whole bunch of stuff at another place. I didn't, thankfully, and actually it's one of the interesting things that I learned working as associate provost a number of years ago, is that these things would be negotiated. So instead of coming up before your 11th semester, maybe your mandatory date would be the 9th or the 7th semester because of stuff you did at another place. Well, the thing about the mandatory date is that one of the things they will almost never do is delay it. They'll almost never, unless you actually go on like some kind of a full leave, like a medical leave for a whole semester or a year, or a leave to leave the university for a semester or a year or something like that, they will almost never push that date back. So I ask about the years toward tenure, because what can happen if you accelerate the mandatory date and then life happens, you can then find yourself under some extreme duress to get everything done. So I tend to actually really like the language in the guide that says, okay, 11th semester, one of the things you can do if you're a rocket scientist, and we'll get to third year review a little bit later, departments can always recommend that you go up early. And that's one thing that can happen. But one thing they'll almost never do is delay it. Almost no matter what happens.
What do you think the chances are if you come up early with your appointment? I mean, do you think that's realistic to convince?
I think the word in the guide is exceptional. And it's something to the effect of, in exceptional cases, departments may recommend an applicant for tenure or recommend a person for tenure earlier than the mandatory date. What the chances are, and the advice that I've always given folks considering going up for tenure early, is the good thing is, because it's before the mandatory date, and Dean's, please correct me if I'm mistaken on this under the current provost, in that unlike coming up at your mandatory date where it's a hire fire decision, if you don't get tenure at your mandatory date, you are placed on a terminal contract and done. If you come up early and then withdraw or don't get it, it's not the hire fire decision.
It's not, you're able to go up again without prejudice.
Yeah.
Now, that's assuming you haven't been given years of credit. Years of credit, I want to be clear now, because years of credit, barring exceptional circumstances, lock in your mandatory review date as being earlier. That's the trade-off you make, is you say at least 2 years before, and potentially, if it's written into your letter, work that you performed during those years can count toward tenure, but part of that deal is when you now can't go to 8 or 9 years. You have to come up in what year six is with the calendar that you've negotiated.
As I was saying, if the whispers usually are, this person is so good after the third year, think how much better that person is going to be after the fifth year.
I would tend to agree.
As a result, back to Martin's point, the probability, I think, granting early tenure, unless you really have an exceptional record, is relatively low.
It is. Like, again, that's, you're looking for a something that you can truly demonstrate is exceptional.
Right.
And I'll share one personal example. I was an early applicant.
Okay.
And this was back 20 years ago. And the hard part now is that then was that 20 years ago, we didn't have all of the literature databases and all of that stuff. And one of the things that I did in preparing for that was I shared my resume with people in the know, like our ex-dean and some other folks who were encouraging about it. But then, and actually this is a good thing, a good thing to do as well, and especially it's a bit easier now that things are in databases in Google Scholar. I went and looked at all of the assistant professors that had come up in chemistry before me, the past 5 or 6 of them, looked up their records at the time, and was able to demonstrate that mine was better. And that, in effect, I was able to demonstrate that I had published more.
I
mean, I had taught more classes.
School, to your point.
Yes.
By today's standards, I don't think my when I didn't look at that A publication would really qualify, because I didn't have a solid A publication, which would be now required.
Yeah.
So things have changed. So we're not reporting that we came up at a time when Seton Hall was trying to increase its research output, and we looked pretty good.
We're going to revisit that.
We can always go back.
We already have, really.
Yeah, we have. And I probably would say the same thing. I think I would be, whether you get it or not, it's hard to know whether it would have been successful or not, but I think it would have had a much tougher time being successful now than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, I agree.
Because especially after, in my department right after me, I had this great publication record, and then in my department not long after me, Alex Fadid came up and blew it away. So But that's actually one of the things that, and one reason you want to, and especially now early on in careers, is kind of keep an eye on that environment, especially if some folks are coming up before you, because you know, you have departmental standards documents, but the de facto standard still becomes what are the people that have come up fairly recently before you, what did they do? Did they blow the standard away? If they did, then you're going to have to blow the standard away too. Because that's really what the expectation is about. And of course, we all want to be the university where the bar is being continuously raised. And that's, you know, that's also something else from the point of view, again, from the administrative point of view, that's something we're always looking to do. Is make those bars higher. So I would just expect that in a lot of departments now, the faculty themselves have raised the bar higher than the documents, just by what they accomplish in their probationary periods. So that's something to look at. Is just kind of keep an eye on what your colleagues that are coming up ahead of you are doing. And a short version of that is do your best to do more. Helps us move
this is the last discussion. I just want to share a story. This was an emotional story. My third year at Seton Hall, I was having a rough time with a couple of articles. I couldn't get the data that I needed. And so I said, oh, wait, I know where I have to look. And I look, and a person who's hired the same time as I did got a publication in an A-plus journal. And I took a deep breath. And so what I did, picked up all my stuff at the library, walked over to his office, and shook his hand and said, congratulations. I had to make sure that I wasn't overcome with envy.
Yeah.
And that creates, you know, diversion, divisions in the department, and I said, he did well, congratulate him, and move on from there. So I had to work on that. That was something personal for me, yeah. Because I know in some departments, sometimes there can be just a little bit of infighting.
Yeah.
And so anything we can to rein that in, I think is helpful too. Because ultimately, if you want to be here long term, it's all about drawing people in, not pushing people back.
So other things, actually, one other important thing is if you have a conversation, especially related to annual evaluations, which we'll come to in a moment, or related to your tenure date or something like that, and let's say life happens, and there is, let's say, reason to make an alteration to the date, make sure you get that in writing from your dean and the provost, because that's also something that has happened, and misunderstandings have happened in the past that have gotten a little bit ugly. I'm sure Peter will have a
comment. Yeah, well, I'm not going to talk about ugly cases, but I am going to say that the faculty guide is an interesting document, and it tends to contradict itself a lot, and so a general piece of guidance about the faculty guide is, because something seems clear to you in the faculty guide, don't assume that it doesn't need to be spelled out in writing.
Yeah.
And this is particularly the case for leaves of absence. So Article 6.2 of the Faculty Guide discusses leaves of absence, including leaves for the protection and recovery of health, and says that leave of absence shall not count toward the probationary period. But there are other articles that suggest that the default is that it does, and so you need to make sure that you have it clearly spelled out, because you don't want, when an issue arises, someone to say, well, I'm using Article 6.2 and I'm using Article 6.4. So something that's as important as that change, the other thing to note is that we currently don't really have a mechanism for a one semester delay of tenure.
We
don't really have a mechanism. So it is currently unclear, and the revisions of the guide have gone both ways, but it's unclear whether a delay of one semester amounts to a delay at all. Because really, since we only review tenure in the fall, it would have to be no delay or a year.
Right.
And so if you expect to be missing a semester, you need to get something in writing from your dean which would supersede anything else. You want to make sure your dean is talking to the provost.
Yeah.
That makes it clear that you're either coming up at the previously agreed upon date, or you're coming up a year later, because we have no provision for doing a review in the spring. And we're trying to fix this in the guide, but I don't know if we're going to get that.
Yep. And this is actually, it's actually, the situations like this are more common than you think, because when you think about maybe somebody gets a Fulbright or something like that that lasts for one semester, or some type of external fellowship that lasts for one semester, and then the question becomes, is this a leave of absence, or is this something that, you know, where it would alter the clock, or is this something where it would not alter the clock? But then the alteration of the clock can still only be 1 year. And so I think the key point is that if there's anything that happens that may alter the tenure clock in any way, get an agreement in writing from the dean, and that way you have it, that way you're covered, and make sure you have that.
And there's been stickiness over what you've produced during that time away and whether or not that counts.
Yeah, to that point, right. You can have two revised and resubmits to two big journals, but sometimes the review process, even with a revised and resubmit, you may have to do it again and again before it finally gets accepted. In the meantime, the university says, you haven't really properly published according to the criteria set out, so I'm sorry, we can't award you tenure. And then one semester later, the papers have been accepted and, you know, there's that timing effect. And you're just subject to, you know, the whims and the vicissitudes, if you will, of editors and editorial boards.
I would, though, suggest that you think relatively early in your probationary period about what things you can get to publication relatively quickly, because committees are much more sympathetic to the idea that something may come out a little bit late if there's a record of things having come out before. Although technically when it comes out late, especially if it hasn't been fully approved for publication, might not count, you're likely to be given more leeway if you have a well-established record, whereas if the entirety of your publication record is coming out in the spring of your sixth year, then you've got a real problem.
Something beats nothing every time.
Mary, please.
Just like to observe that not everybody here is in the probationary stage.
That's true.
Oh, really?
So
yeah.
I'm sorry. Let's come to some timing on that as well. Sorry, Andy. Just a few things. Let me shoot through some of this stuff. One of the other things to keep an eye on, and I had to reread this stuff again, because, of course, they have worked on Article 3 in the Senate in the past couple of years. But keep an eye on these annual reviews and annual renewals for probationary folks. I think actually one of the things also that can be helpful, even in the, you know, Andy can be helpful in a full professor as well, is to have some annual evaluations. Even though we tend to be, we're less requiring on that of tenured faculty, to have some of those same types of evaluations in there, because you're still going to get asked about, well, you know, are you still a good teacher? And those sorts of things, and to have some classroom observations and all of that good stuff in there. One of the things that is a little, and again, this is something you want to keep on top of. Just keep on top of your department chairs, because your chair is also one of the most harassed individuals on campus. So, you know, they're stuck worse in the middle than these deans here are. And Mary and I know this full well with the amount of years that we served as department chairs, and Tony still does. And, yeah. Department chairs tend to forget things because they are the most harassed people on campus. What that means is that just kind of keep an eye on this. So first year folks, if you haven't been told you're not coming back next year by now, you're coming back. So.
and I would like to say, I don't know about other colleagues, I don't know about the library. We have not, for example, been able in my college to get caught up enough to give third year candidates notice of their reappointment by September 1st of their third year.
So
that's not happening in my college. I don't know about if you're...
But what's kind of interesting is that the faculty guide doesn't actually specify dates for the annual reviews.
It's driven by the notification, from the provost or the dean.
Yep.
And the failure to notify sort of presumptively allows you to continue.
Right.
So the burden is on us, which is why it's not as bad as it might be that we fail to deliver these things.
Greg, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But please remind, please remind your department chairs that you need to be evaluated each year. And I would suggest perhaps in each fall, when you come back in the fall, remind your department chair, hey, I need to be evaluated this year. Can you set up some classroom observations? Can you set up some things so we have those letters in hand in time for these deadlines?
And I would say the more important than those deadlines is having those by the end of the year in the record, so that when you go up for tenure, there's an understanding of the guidance that you've been given over time.
Because I can say also, as a rank and tenure committee member, one of the things that I really love to read, especially in tenure applications, is to see from the annual evaluations a little bit of that story of progress. You know, kind of like to see a first-year evaluation where, hey, we saw some things in your lecture style, in your classroom style, work on these, and then you see in the later ones how you worked on them. And to see that and to see that kind of a progression in the annual reviews, you know, from the departmental colleagues is one of the things that that really plays very strongly in a tenure application, I think. Mary, would you agree with that? That?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. And so keep an eye on that. And then when you get to the third year, and again, different, you know, departments will do this at different stages in the year. When you're in your third year, one of the things that was instituted under our previous provost, Dr. Robinson, was a stronger, and so again, a fairly recent thing in our institutional history, was third year, it was a stronger third year review process, and that is now expected. And that's a really good time when you think about the sort of standard tenure clock, where you would apply for tenure in the 11th semester. So the third year is what, the fifth and sixth semesters. So if you think about that review taking the whole year. Now here's an interesting thing. When you hit the ninth semester, you know, when you show up the first day of your ninth semester, also under the guide, you have the right to apply for tenure in the 11th semester. And you hit that year before. Once you show up and you're renewed for that last year before your tenure application, you get to where you have the right. So counting back, that's, you know, the ninth semester. So then the seventh semester is, you know, the year before that. So you're looking at that third year review in that fifth and sixth semesters. What that does is if issues come up, you're not publishing enough. No publications in Class A journals will be sick. What's wrong with you?
That's correct.
You know, you get that.
I only hit one just for the last 5 years. So yeah.
You get that third year review that says that you still have time to address it. Because when you, you know, there's almost a little bit of a point of no return when you get to that ninth semester because, yeah, you have the right to apply. However, it's going to go in the 11th semester when you actually fill out the forms and everything. That, you know, you have that right once you hit the ninth semester. Because by then they can't not renew you for the next year.
Right.
So you are there at your 11th semester.
Mm-hmm. Unless we dismiss you for cause.
Unless, yeah. Unless, yeah. So,
I have a question,
y'all.
Please. This is, you're getting into this later,
yeah.
But when we come up, we have, you know, three different categories.
Mm-hmm.
How would you rank them in terms of importance?
That's a great question, and I would, you know, I would say if I have to do it a little bit physically, I'm going to say scholarship, teaching, service. I'm going to say the two because I think there are a few things. One of the things you're, the rank and tenure standard documents, at least the ones in the expectations type documents that I've read from all the departments, they almost all start off with you will do X, Y, Z in scholarship, whatever that is. You know, publish X number of papers, have a consistent publication record, 5 paintings, 3 movies, whatever it is that they're kind of looking for. Publications in Class A journals, that sort of thing.
Well, did you say shifts again and come up for full?
Yes, I would say that shifts up for full for scholarship and everything else.
Yeah, I think
much.
That goes up, yeah. It doesn't. I mean, I'm thinking we served on the rank and tenure committee together, yet service, not that we don't only expect excellent teaching, but I feel like service starts to at least even out of teaching as opposed to maybe even trumping teaching, because we're not just looking at service here at the university, we're looking at service.
We're looking for leadership.
And that happens.
We're looking for leadership at the full professional level. So that actually that's a good way to talk a little bit about the transition. So when I think about that, Peter, go ahead.
I was just gonna give my own response on the scholarship teaching and service, and I would be I'm gonna not exactly do it the way Nick did, but I think there's an understanding that teaching and scholarship have to be excellent,
yes.
And that service is important, but people serve in different kinds of ways, and people who are more active scholars, more dedicated teachers, in some ways that can mitigate less involvement in service, whereas I think we don't want good researchers who are bad teachers or good teachers who are bad researchers, and we don't really want people who are not university citizens either, but there are a lot more ways to be university citizens, and there's a lot more, I think, elasticity in what that ends up being for different people. So,
one piece of wisdom actually that I got from Phil Kao in one of these sessions many, many years ago from this guy, Phil Kao. And Phil is also one of these people. He probably also, I was served on rank and tenure committees many years, and I kind of learned how to be a rank and tenure committee member from Phil, who I think was on the college, except for the required year off, Phil was like on the college rank and tenure committee every possible year he could be on it, I think, over the years. And he basically said by the time you come up for tenure, we're still a relatively small community, and by the time you come up for tenure, Phil kind of felt that you at least ought to have a clue who you are. That you've done enough things out in the university that you're not a total complete stranger to, let's say, the committee members at the college level. You probably will be a bit of a complete stranger to a few of the university committee members just because they're from all over the campus. But really, within our within our colleges, and especially, which can be in arts and sciences, a little bit of a challenge because it is a big college. So one thing also to talk with senior faculty in your department about is sort of a little bit of a progression of that service. So as an assistant professor, jump on some committees. Pick some that are actually of interest to you, that where you can make a real contribution.
To get engaged in those committees, I think quality is important, if not more important than quantity. So I think what the members of committees that you've been on will remember about you is probably not that you're sitting there doing email on your laptop, but that you've made contributions.
Why'd you look at me when you said
that? I don't know.
You
don't have any idea about that.
That you made a meaningful contribution and I remember that contribution.
But then you think about, when I think about the progression then at, following tenure, that's when I think, okay, I'm going to get on this committee. And one of the personal decisions that I made is that most of the time when I get on a committee these days, I want to serve on it. I'll raise my hand and volunteer to chair it, or volunteer to work with the chair and do a little bit more. Because also as a tenured faculty member, the time gets even more and more precious. And if I'm going to serve on the thing, I want it to be a valuable use of my time for me as well as for the committee. And that's, I think that's, make sure that when you, if you get the value from your time that you want to get from it, I think the service and the quality of the service will probably take care of itself.
I ask tenure candidates how they're going to use their tenure to benefit the institution, including through service and leadership. And I ask, I basically ask the same thing of candidates for full professor. One of the things I want to see out of a candidate for full professor, I don't want to put it quite this way, it's not that I want them to make my life easier. I want to have assurance that they're committed to making the college a better place.
Yeah.
And that they understand that leadership is sometimes
difficult.
And if you're not willing to challenge not just the administration but your own colleagues, then tenure isn't worth much.
As the dean, that's not always making your life easier.
No, it isn't.
Actually, I think some of us would argue that one of the ways you make your college a better place is to
hold the dean accountable.
Yes, is to absolutely.
But not just the dean, your colleagues as well.
Yes.
I was thinking of something that's kind of tangential. When we come up for tenure, you go through so many committees, right? You go through your department, you go through your college, you go through the university, and so forth and so on. And I was wondering how you go and kind of navigate all those different committees. The more you go up, the less people know about you, your profession, and just presenting yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a great. I've got a little. Actually, I want to jump ahead to that stuff. Just a few of the good things, that's a great segue to jump ahead to some of the good practical stuff. So anyway, the big thing about Article 3 and sort of the nature of your appointment is get in there, check those deadlines, get with your department chair and or your dean, and kind of make sure that that your files on that stuff are complete, and that's a good thing to do as you go. So at the beginning of the year, make sure your department sets you up for annual reviews. At the end of the year, maybe check back to be sure you have all the stuff. If somebody observed your classroom, did you get a letter from them? If you met with the chair, get the chair, and especially before that chair disappears, and especially if you have a change in your department chair, make sure the outgoing chair actually does their job on the layout and writes that and writes your evaluation. And many of us have to get
distracted by things, and there are many ways of minimizing distractions. One of them is to make sure there's nothing missing, because if something's missing, the first thing that will come to a committee member's mind is that it's missing for a reason. And that reason is usually does not want your benefit.
I'm just saying, too, I think it's incumbent upon department chairs to shepherd the faculty,
yes.
too. Sometimes that gets pushed aside. And so I think it's important for the department chair to say, make sure you cover this and this and this. You need help on your research projects. I'm happy to come to your class and see what I can do to help you. I think that's incumbent upon us.
Yes.
You know, granted, some people said, it's, as you said before, it can be a rough job, but that's what you're volunteering for to be in that position.
I think incumbent upon that to do that or to organize senior faculty to help.
Oh, exactly. Precisely.
Because you can't, it's hard to do it all. But.
And back to some of the things we're saying here, I agree about, you know, you're really being tenured in some sense for future productivity, not past productivity.
Yep.
And, you know, as you advance, you get to the full professor stage, increasingly your role will be, I think, as a leader and as a shepherd for the university, representing, you know, how we can raise the standards and, if you will, pull things up together across departments.
I think growth mindset is really valuable. So you're not just showing what you've accomplished, but what you're going to accomplish.
Yep.
And that's why, again, as Nick said, it's not as good if you don't have, I mean, I'm not encouraging you to intentionally blow a class, but if the evidence of progress is evidence of future progress.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to speak up just a little bit about, we're talking about the stuff that goes down the heart of the plate, but every discipline is very, very, there's a constant dialogue here about talking across disciplines. So it's not just what we do in the university libraries. It's also what nurses do in clinical situations. It's what sociologists do in community work. It's what folks in here over here in the College of Ed do in terms of field work, some of the licensure requirements so that they're allowed to teach in certain areas, data sets that you produce, that you make available. So I you know, we in many ways it's incumbent upon the candidate not only to present evidence but to situate evidence as well. We do this all the time. Our last rank and tenure case was one where you know, I kept putting a draft back under the person's nose and saying, you got to tell us why we should care about that. And so it is a situation where, and if like the current faculty guide, there are certain requirements or within the rank and tenure structure, certain kinds of work requirements, it's incumbent upon you and your department to situate those and to explain what role this plays in your overall career. So document, 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 document.
And have as many people as possible give you advice.
Yep.
And I think one of the things that's hard about tenure and promotion is that, although everyone's, I mean, chairs should be guiding people through this, at the end of the day, the burden of proof is on the candidate to make an affirmative case for tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And if that case is not made, excuses are not really pertinent. And so you have to own your file in a lot of ways. And you may find that people give conflicting advice, and you're going to have to, and that's, I mean, at least when you have conflicting advice, you have multiple things to weigh, and you need to position yourself strategically. At the end of the day, what you submit, you're going to have to do because you believe that it's the strongest case that you can present. And going back later on and saying that you give them that advice
doesn't cut it.
We will feel sorry for you, and we if you determine that that's what happened, then it won't get you tenure. And that's the unfortunate reality of the situation. And so it's not. They're typically not do-overs.
But the classic is, even the liberal arts struggle with this.
Yeah.
The classic is that Greg Burton always talks about is, you get an Kenyon review or grant time. That probably means zip to you.
And in my call,
it's a big deal.
Yeah. But he's actually a reader, so.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll point to me.
Okay, point to me.
But it's, you know, it would not necessarily mean a tremendous amount to you, but it's a big deal. And it's widely read, and it won't be widely cited either. There's going to be no H index on that one.
And what a successful application looks like within my college in different areas is actually different.
Yeah.
I mean, a humanities discursive discipline and a lab-based research discipline what it looks like to get to that stage that we decide is worthy of tenure, it sort of has a different gestalt, so to speak. But you also have to be sensitive to the fact that you're going to have readers of your material who won't come to it from your perspective, so you have to figure out how to translate.
So I want to come back
to
Marta's question about helping that, navigating that through the process. It's one of the things, again, a couple of pieces of advice from some of the old guard. Again, another practical piece of advice, and then I'll address Marta's question directly, is that another thing you can do that does kind of relate to, especially to service and those sorts of things. Whenever you do something like substitute teach for somebody's class, I send you a thank you note. What Phil suggested, this is in the old school, I'm still in the old school. Phil suggested, just getting a shoebox or a file box and writing the word evidence on it, and print out a copy of that, or you have a copy of that, throw it in there, and at the end of each year, look at your stack of those evidence things that you have and organize them. A couple of things, but now navigating a little bit all of the different folks in the disciplines, and I'll share this with you, being a chemist, a chemist who came up 20 years ago, this was an even bigger challenge, I think, in some ways than it is today, because today we do have those nice H-index measures and things like that, so I can go there and just say my H-index is better, and people tend to get that, or at least have heard what that is, and my citation rate is all of this. And especially for full professor, where you really have to make a positive case, because it's not a hire fire decision. You come up for full professor and you don't get it, we're not firing you. So that also, there's a flip side, that's good, but there's also a flip side to that, which basically says to me as a reviewer, what's the wow factor in this application? Why should I promote you today instead of 3 years from now to full professor? And that's a reasonable question for a rank and tenure committee member to ask. And this is where I need to be brought into your discipline a little bit. Wow, this is the best work in this area. Here I'm among the best in the world. Here are these colleagues that I work with that are the luminaries in the field. Here I'm not serving on the editorial board of the journal. They just made me an associate editor. All of those sorts of things that just say, wow, promote me today, because as a committee member and even as an administrator at the full professor level, they're almost looking for excuses to say no. And so, just make it, and even at the tenure level, do everything you can to kind of make it impossible to say no. I'll share one that happened a number of years ago. I can share this because the guy's long gone from the university. The guy had a terrific record coming up for full professor. He had a terrific guy, a couple of books, big time, lots of great reviews, sold thousands and thousands of copies of them and all this stuff, had all that demonstrating. At the same time, this applicant might as well have filled out the forms in pencil. And it was a really easy, at least for me as a committee member, it was a really easy no vote.
Proofread.
And things like that, so even little things. But bring us in. One of the things, do take a lot of care in that short space you have in the narrative sections of the application to put that narrative in there and tell your story in words that, you probably don't have to impress your departmental colleagues with those words as much as you want to impress the rank and tenure committee who are not in your department, in words that the dean can understand.
It is because the dean's really slow on the uptake.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a practice in other places, but I know when I was coming up, it was in arts and sciences to find the people and first get a copy of their successful tenure promotion application or their promotion application to look at it, see what it looked like. Because especially as a probationary faculty member, I didn't see them. Because we didn't vote on them.
Yeah.
So I hadn't seen anybody's application. So I reached out to a few colleagues I knew who I could tap and say, can I look at your promotion, at your application? And by the same token, offering to read people's applications, which I
did
a lot.
So Andy, if helpful at all, I still have my old school applications that were in three-ring binders. And because we don't want to
play tablets.
But the thing is, I don't have my tenure application because I shared that with a junior colleague who never gave it back. But my full professor application I still have. And if anybody wants to look at that, because the other thing is, there's also a battle that you'll face against, putting everything in and being concise as well.
two things I want to reinforce really quickly. One is the point that Nick, you're making about not making unforced errors.
Yeah.
And another way that that can come up is committees reading tenure and promotion files are, they're looking for quality, but they're also looking for quantity of productivity. I mean, it's a reality. It shouldn't be just counting words, but they're looking to see that you're producing multiple original works. I think candidates are best served by explaining when material's been recycled or when multiple articles are based on the same data set or the results of the same research, because if you don't do that, it might look like you have more research until people start digging, at which point they'll say, hey, actually, this book chapter is the same as this article, at which point they start digging it into everything in a way that may not serve your case. Your file needs a certain kind of scrutiny. So when I went up for tenure, I had articles that were related to book chapters, and I would say, you know, this conference presentation is the same as article number 12.
Right.
And X percentage of my book is in these articles. And I think if you don't do that, what you're inviting is for the committees to become detectives, and that doesn't serve you well. The second thing I want to say is about the, Nick, you said that people are looking for reasons to deny tenure.
I would say more so for
promotion, but I think for tenure, I mean, and we said this at the beginning, but, you know, Nick, you asked me what tenure is for, and we talk about things like academic freedom and governance and job security. But institutions have tenure because tenure benefits institutions. There are forces pushing the other way.
Yeah.
Higher education is changing very quickly. Enrollment patterns in my college are changing very quickly. My life would be easier in some ways if we didn't have tenure. And not just faculty who talk back to me like Mary, right? So, but in terms of my being able to make decisions in a timely manner, because I commit to a faculty member, I commit to their research agenda, their future for the next 30 or 40 years, you have to present an affirmative case that makes it more important for me to promote you than for me to look at what's the options I could have if I didn't have to lock you in for 30 years. And that's a certain kind of burden. And tenure it exists for the benefit of the institution, and it secondarily benefits faculty members. It's not the other way around. And so you have to convince a committee that the university should invest in you. And it's, these days it's many millions of dollars, and make a decision that can't be easily undone, whereas other kinds of decisions can. And so if you see that as the bar you have to jump, then the wow thing becomes, even for tenure, I think more important.
But how do you temper that? Because then you get into the, I mean, I guess I'm some naming, but I hear a lot of things, and you know what we don't want to get in the mindset of is, I mean, what I personally don't want to have to be put in the position to do is to come up with an application that says, hey, I'm so good, if you don't give me tenure, I'm just going to go somewhere else. Like, I don't want
to put in
that position.
It doesn't have to be that.
Yeah.
But I would be lying if I said tenure committees didn't think about keeping you for however many years as opposed to what's behind door number three.
Yeah.
Let me give you the exact quote from the dean of faculty at not this institution, but a small liberal arts college about 27 years ago. He was talking to my friend, and he was talking about this exact situation, and he said, basically, when I make my decision, I'm going to ask myself, can I do better? It's cold. And the answer was no, but you know, you're tenured and here you go.
It's also, one thing that makes it a little bit is we have invested in you, right?
Yeah, right.
We've invested time, we've invested money, we've invested energy. You're the scientist, we've invested
research
equipment that other people might not be able to make the same use of. That works in your favor, but that's still dwarfed by the existential decision about the future of the institution,
right? It's a $5 or $6 million decision.
but also, one of the things that academics, and not just them, but we do have a problem with it, and I will say, especially, I'm going to slightly sexist, especially women. We don't do well at bragging about ourselves and saying how good we are, how wonderful we are. We are not good salespeople in academia. You know, we have learned how to be deferential to our thesis advisors, to hiring committees. But when you come up for tenure, you need to sit there and basically say, I am damn good, you better give it to me. I don't want to say I'm going to go somewhere else, but you need to say.
Yes, you're not now.
I'm good.
That's good.
Especially if you're coming up for full, but at any stage, to say, I have done work. I am an exceptional teacher. People don't want to say, oh, I'm a pretty good teacher. No, you're a damn good teacher. And so, but for me, you need to practice. Get somebody an interview with them. They can ask you hard questions.
Jim, I spent two solid weekends with one candidate helping him rewrite the entire thing. Because
I'm not selling this. It's got to be
practice. I'm here getting people. He's going to say no.
Yeah. You don't want to be an obnoxious jerk.
And avoid generic statements.
Yeah, right.
About yourself. If your file looks like everyone else's file, then on some level, or is indistinguishable from other files, it's just sort of generic file that's just kind of that's fine, then you're not doing one of the things I think you have to do, which is catch the reviewer's attention, get a sense that there's something there that's more than meh, you know?
So I want to get into, there's a kind of wild, wild west these days with publications. Mm-hmm. So there is such a thing as an open access, peer-reviewed, legitimate publication. And so you also, it's not just your work, it's not just this odd thing, you know, Jim Kimball curating an exhibition that got massive publicity around the world, but how does he fit that in? It's also situating the actual publication that you're doing. Handbook chapters can be peer reviewed. They can also be open access. They can also be found in a print. So you've got to have, and that is where we have stepped in several times in the university libraries to help people begin to situate their publications so that they don't get dinged with having to prove that they're legitimate.
But I think at the same time, John, you know, every discipline is different.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to be really careful with open access.
OA and science is a whole different thing than...
I was going to say, I think some things that I found helpful are things like acceptance rates.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you everything, but if a journal is accepting 9 out of 10 articles, people have a legitimate reason to ask how rigorous the peer review is. Acceptance rates, citations, reviews, those kinds of things are a way of showing
some sort of documented how this goes through a blind peer review or a double peer review process.
Most journals have statements about that that you can copy out of the journal.
Right.
If they don't, you can write the editors and they can usually do something and you can put that in your file. But that's really important because you're right, peer review has become a very broad term and it includes a lot of different things.
Someone from the House of Lords read this.
Yeah. But also, in some disciplines, speaking to general audience is important.
Yes.
Political science, for example, could be important, right? That you're being published in an op-ed in the New York Times, and that's not peer review, but it's important for different reasons.
Yeah. For foreign affairs.
For foreign affairs, yeah.
But I mean, there are a lot of ways you can kind of enable that. I mean, when you're writing, you can put in the narrative quotes from other things. You can, I think that's the thing is you want to enhance your narrative with facts that you bring in and put them in there so that there a lot of people want to go and look at everything that you have, even though you know exactly what it is.
Yep.
So put the most important things in that document. That's for selling yourself.
So now look at that. We managed to have a great free-form discussion, which is terrific. We actually are coming up on the end of our actually scheduled time. So if you have to run, don't. But I thought one of the things I did want to focus. I think we've kind of hit on almost everything that was actually in the slides that the free-form discussion has gone on. That's been terrific. It's much more fun than slides and hopefully helpful. A couple of key points before folks get away. I think one of the number one key points to you folks, one of the things you have had in this room is you've seen the names and faces of a few more senior folks and a couple of deans who by coming here have expressed an interest in being helpful in these matters. Please, you can reach out to us, and I think any of us who've been here today for with any additional questions, for clarification, for help, I mean,
you know, with all the documentation and everything that we do about rank and tenure process and things, it still is kind of mysterious and scary. And it will be a very strange year when you get up to tenure. But a few things that I did, you know, that are probably a little bit less emphasized that we did talk about. Clearly, the bar is going higher for the scholarly expectations. One thing I would also say, though, Seton Hall will not tenure or promote somebody who is a bum in the classroom. You know, if you've got a teaching record that's full of student complaints, that massive publication record probably will not save you. So make sure that we don't go to the extremes here that they do at some R1s where it's research this much and everything else this much, although even that is changing a little bit.
You said something about external letters.
Yes, actually I do want to talk about that because there is no, unfortunately, and my colleagues have spent more years on the Faculty Senate than I have, and I can debate this history a little bit, but external review has been a political of rank and tenure applications has been a political football at this university for the last 20 years. I'll go back to the year again, that year that I came up for tenure 20 years ago. Nobody said anything about getting external reviews of your applications until we got to the University Rank and Tenure Committee in January of that year. And I was informed at that point that the university committee wants external letters. Of course, what it really was is that the provost wanted external letters, but he just kind of managed to do this through the university committee. He was very subtle about it. And I said, okay, fine. So, well, we managed to get the external letters, and that got done. But then various discussions went back and forth with things, but it, still, the university-wide, there is no policy for external reviews in tenure and promotion applications. That being said, many of our departmental standards and expectations documents have some procedure in there. That being said, you can expect that they will be expected.
Well, and they will be in the new faculty guide.
Well,
they will not be required in the faculty guide stipulations. The drafts I've seen until recently are stipulations about how they are to be gathered, if
right.
they are gathered on the
right.
faculty
it's
guide.
It's basically about process and so on, but I think it suggests that the...
We're prepared. And what I would say is that external letters, especially if they're not your best friends, help provide information that is hard to get from other sources. And while they're still not part, and they won't be required of a new faculty guide, that kind of information about how you're viewed by colleagues, the ability of someone outside of the institution to put together what you're doing in an objective narrative, if you don't have it through external letters and you don't have it through any other means, that will weaken your case. So my official line about external letters now is that they're not required, they're not needed, but if you're not going to provide them, think about what purpose they serve and how you can achieve that same purpose as something other than external letters. And I'm not answering the question of whether it can actually be done or not. But
I think that the language implies rather strongly that other people are doing it, and at the very least what happens is that the department has been doing this differently because there hasn't been an official policy. And so the departments do have to, or the candidate will have to indicate, first of all, how the letters are solicited. And so I think you're right. It doesn't come flat out and say they're required because, it's going to be difficult to fall. But there's so much information in there that if you don't do it, you're basically sabotaging yourself. Frankly, even now, you're still sabotaging yourself.
And I haven't read a single file in the last 3 years that hasn't had external letters in it. Well, have they been gathered various?
That's the question. And the committees have struggled with how those letters were collected.
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
And I actually did have one a few years ago, when I was on the committee. It was the one of all the applications we looked at in the committee that year. There was one that didn't happen, which made that one stand out, and that stood out in a negative way because I still, without, you know, the applicant also didn't do the greatest job presenting themselves, and so I still had trouble figuring out what they were trying to do.
John actually had a question.
Go on, at least.
Since at least, as I was saying,
Tom has a question.
Usually it's multiple, usually the question is.
And also, like, how, I understand.
You think it's going to be your whole advice? You say, I didn't know this person, so they're next to the field that I know that they're not my friends.